This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
In a place like Southeast Asia, it's really understanding the flows of water and sea level rise. So it's about setbacks from coastal edges. It's about understanding the major green spaces that exist in these places to protect and enhance.
What might our cities look like by 2050? We ask an architect and urban planner commissioned by the National Geographic magazine to answer just that question. Plus, a listed building comes of age in London and part one of our series on the changing face of the office. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Overpopulation, pollution, and a lack of green space are just some of the pressing concerns facing the world's cities today. So, what will the cities look like in future? Architect and urban planner Daniel Ringelstein believes that, beyond futuristic stereotypes of flying cars, the most resilient cities will be the ones that best tackle the threats at hand. Ringelstein was part of a team at American architecture and urban planning company Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. SOM for short, which was commissioned last month by National Geographic magazine to envision what their hypothetical city of the future would look like by 2050. This show's very producer, Daphne Karnesis, spoke with Ringelstein recently to find out just a little more.
All of us are very enamored by National Geographic, and in recent issues, they really have been looking at the issues of planetary health and the environments, which is something that really impassions us to do our work with a vision towards the future and future generations.
And when people think of a future city, we often tend to think of futuristic automatically, you know, things like flying cars, some of the stereotypes. But I think one of the great things about this research is that it's not futuristic, it's actually quite tangible. And tell us a bit about the time frame as well. I think it's meant to be 2050.
Yeah, that's right. So we had a very good dialogue with them about that point. We didn't want to go too far out in the future that it was unrealistic. We wanted something, a future time frame that everyone, particularly the younger generation, maybe even ourselves, would still experience going forward. And something that required us to be much more realistic, yet still far enough out in the future to think and dream up new ideas. The year 2050 was a good agreed date to really focus on, because that is when global urban growth is set to be heading over 9.8 billion people around the world. So that was a good target and a good challenge to address.
And just, I guess, in broad brush strokes, what does it look like, this city? The location? And does it have a name even?
No, it doesn't have a name. It's just a future city. And it doesn't have a specific location. We really wanted it to be generic in sort of geography. And also in terms of whether it's a new city or an existing city, the ideas that we put forth in this challenge, we saw as applying to many different geographies, many different climatic regions, and many different urban conditions, whether they be in a well-developed European city or an emerging or brand new city in an emerging market, whether it be Africa, China, or Southeast Asia.
And how much does a city of the future have to do with the past? I mean, how can you design a city without destroying, I guess, what made this city in the first place? Because when you look at some of the most popular cities in the world, they're popular because of their history. So how did you manage to reconcile those two competing forces?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a big part of the conversation we're having today in our more recent work and working with our architectural studios is how to rehabilitate and recycle buildings, recycle urban environments. The project really took on lots of different scales, from the most largest regional scale and city scale down to a building scale. And so our principles were sort of listed out relative to each of those scales. In terms of the building scale, it is very much about reinterpreting what a city urban building is. How does it contribute to its invocant environment? And how can it be designed, if it's a new building, in a flexible manner so that the program can change, the spaces can be used by different communities? If it's an existing building, how can you recycle its materials? How can you recycle its spaces and give it new life?
And one of the things that's interesting also about your proposal and your research is that it looks quite a bit about the link between cities and nature and biodiversity. And I think one of the things that always interests me is how cities and the countryside can coexist and come closer without, you know, people in cities feeling, as we do often now, the need to escape the cities to the countryside. And also, you know, this idea that if you build a city or as the city grows, it's slowly destroying the nature around it. And I think it ties into a concept that you call biomorphic urbanism. Is that right?
Yeah, you've hit the main theme that we saw as the most important thing to cut across all scales. So we feel that future cities should be designed through ecology, understanding the natural systems, the natural forces of a particular place, the natural landscape, whether it be terrestrial or water-based landscapes, the natural topography, and the climate, as I was just saying before. So it really should be a landscape ecologically led approach, and hence the term bio for the ecology part and morphic for the form. So the city form, in our view, really needs to be driven by ecology and the natural systems that apply to a particular place.
So how does that manifest itself? What specific examples?
So in our regional strategy, for example, we were setting out a strategy of developing a series of urban hubs. And these urban hubs could be made up of 8 to 10 neighborhoods or urban districts that would form a compact cluster of autonomous city, whether it's a business district that's also infused with culture and entertainment and housing, whether it's a residential neighborhood that also has all the amenities it needs on its own, schools, again, cafes, and some local workplaces. So densifying and creating these compact hubs would allow us to then put these across a region in a way that allow the natural systems to remain in place. So it's not promoting sprawl, it's really compact growth with greenways between. So in the Middle East, it would be really embracing things like the natural water systems mm-hmm. that are there today. Mm-hmm. In a place like Southeast Asia, it's really understanding the flows of water and sea level rise. So it's about setbacks from coastal edges. It's about understanding the major green spaces that exist in these places to protect and enhance.
And to formulate this kind of vision of the city, you looked at a lot of real and actual projects and initiatives to inform the research. What are some examples? Can you talk me through some of them, some good examples of, I guess, what cities are doing right at the moment?
Yeah, I think many of our existing cities in the Western world are challenging themselves with how to reinvigorate and create a new identity for themselves and how to address sort of the fabric that's falling apart and a post-industrial world. So it's really about intensifying and also dealing with growth. So many of these Western cities are experiencing tremendous growth. So it's about how to densify. Maybe it's Paris that has typical low-rise development, but there's now a need to understand the economic benefit that Paris has for a wider global community. So how can you insert taller buildings into that sensitive fabric? So that's an example. In a place like China or Southeast Asia, it's much more hyperdense scale, where you have tremendous amounts of people moving into more urban environments. How can you do that in a way that still allows the green and the breathable fresh air to come through these more dense cities as they grow? So we also use a lot of our practice in these new places, in places like Jakarta, mm-hmm. in Malaysia, and of course throughout China. I come from Chicago, and one of the most amazing projects there is the rebirth of Grant Park. So here is a living room space that was set out in the 1900s. By Daniel Burnham, which is the living room of the city, but it got tired. So adding in elements of performance, of art, so this is in the form of Millennium Park, adding in a whole new playground for children in the form of Maggie Daly Park has created a whole new buzz for downtown, a whole new identity for the place, not just for Chicagoans, but it's also raised the amount of interest in North America and even around the world. The tourism now is coming to Chicago has doubled in the last 10 years. Not all to do with these things, but has a big role to play. So providing civic pride and new projects infused in an existing environment, that's a great example.
Amazing. And just towards the end of the interview, what do you think about past attempts that we've seen to create future cities? You know, I know that through your research, you looked at things like Ebenezer Howard's Garden Cities, the English Planner. How do you think they did?
Yeah, it's very dangerous, isn't it, sometimes to say, here is the vision for the future. I think cities are very complex organisms, and to have a singular idea about the form and shape of a city is probably going down the wrong track. It's really about, and there's no silver bullet to define what a livable future city is. It's a series of layers. They're very complex organisms in terms of all the understandings from an infrastructure point of view, from energy, water, and waste, livability, economics. For us, it's about collaborating with people within our practice, the architects, engineers, planners, but also outside our practice, understand the sociology of a place, understand the landscape flows of a place, as I said before, and really work together as a team to, you know, address each layer individually, but then make sure it sort of comes together in a comprehensive solution. So, yeah, I think we would suggest veering away from a simple drawing or a diagram, and that's what we were trying to do here as well. We're trying to focus the article on principles, on strategies. The illustrations just give a sense of what it could look like, but it's not meant to be the next vision for City Universelle, for example.
So, Daniel, obviously one of the pressing concerns now is climate change and how cities can adapt to that. How have you addressed that in your research?
Yeah, I think the whole premise of our strategy or series of strategies here is to promote more sustainable means of building urban places that is also going to help to restore and protect the precious resources of our planet. So creating great places for people to live and work in more compact places, respecting and restoring natural systems that have been cut off in the past, getting people to move about these places in a much more sustainable manner, reduce the need to travel in the first place as a strong principle that we always practice. So mixed places, vibrant places, using technology to make people aware of their environments and the impact they have on the environment. So these strategies are all meant to not only talk about how to create a great city in the future, but then how you can do it in a way that is also at the same time going to reduce carbon and address climate change. Just take transport, for example. Transport is one of the biggest causes of greenhouse emissions, particularly if you fossil fuel powered transit. So take, for example, Shenzhen, who has just transformed their entire bus fleet in the space of 2 years, which is 18,000 vehicles, from diesel-powered buses to electrical buses. They did that because they had an imperative to deal with their poor air quality. And they did it actually in record time. And so I think that's a model for other cities to follow. It's a quite simple thing to do, but even at a large scale. So I think London's trying to do this. Many of the places, Paris is going to prohibit fossil fuel vehicles in their city by 2040, if not earlier. So I think just addressing that one little point, electrifying our transit would go a long way to addressing climate change.
Amazing. And just finally, are you working on any other interesting projects? I'm sure you are research at the moment. Is there anything that you can reveal to us and what we can expect?
Well, the firm is continuing to collaborate on lots of amazing new projects in the East, in China in particular. So we've just finished a new city plan in Chengdu. We're working on a new city plan near Beijing. I can't reveal the details of it, but it's a very exciting project. It's really looking to be a model for a new kind of an urban environment in the East. We're working throughout Europe and cities to look at how we can intensify rail interchange in a way that promotes development, promotes exchange, and densifies places in the cities that also are urban ruptures in the urban fabric. So healing the sense of connectivity in the city. And in the States, we're doing a lot of community planning, reaching out to the local communities and neighborhoods much more than we did before, and to involve people in the process of scripting their future.
And hats off to Daniel Ringelstein of architecture and urban planning firm SOM, speaking to Monocle's very own Daphne Karnesis. You might not have heard the name Bracken House, but London architecture buffs may have seen the Grade 2 star listed building, framed beside the imposing white stone dome of St Paul's Cathedral. Bracken House is so good they listed different parts of it on two separate occasions, first in 1987 and then again in 2013. It was first built by Sir Albert Richardson in 1959, then extended by Michael Hopkins and partners in the late 80s. For some context, it was the first post-war building in London to receive such lauded status. The needs of a workplace have changed dramatically since the original occupants, the Financial Times newspaper, if you've heard of them, moved in a half century ago. But sensitive redevelopment was sorely needed to bring the building up to date. John Robertson Architects were commissioned to carry out the transformation, which has just been completed. But how do you bring a listed building into the heart of the 21st century without suffering too many trials, tribulations or compromises? David Mager, director at John Robertson Architects and project director for Bracken House, sat down with Monocle's ever-patient Christy Evans to discuss the architectural journey.
The brief originally was to upgrade the building, reposition it, reimagine it so it would be 21st century ready. And at that stage, in the early stages of the design process, there wasn't a particular end user in mind. They wanted a higher impact entrance and reception area where you could meet, greet, break out. Certainly it needed to be that initial statement space as you arrived in the building. They wanted to improve accessibility and connectivity between the various layers of the building, the 1950s and the 1990s. They wanted to add to the improvement of the environment. So that was improving the building services, the lighting, the energy performance of the building, and also to introduce some element of wellness. So they asked us to look at the roof terrace But we worked very closely with the architects who the FT directly appointed. And it was a good collaboration because, of course, they had to work within the historic fabric as much as we did. So there was a very good synergy between us and a good understanding of the building. And both of us wanted to make the best of what Bracken House is, which is a very special, almost unique, bespoke workplace building.
So obviously you had to change a lot within the building to bring it into the 21st century, which would involve changing the infrastructure, I assume. How did you go about doing that, considering the protected nature?
Every change that we had to undertake for the building really was a collaboration that we had to undertake with all the different organisations and bodies you have to deal with in designing with a listed building. So in other words, we had to have discussions with the City of London first and foremost, because they're the primary planning authority, and deal with their conservation officers with the listing building consent side of things. We then opted to discuss the project with the 20th Century Society, who are an interest group, but quite a powerful one, who take a special interest in modernist icons like Bracken House is. So we had to make sure they were happy with the design. We also had to talk to Heritage, or Historic England, I should say, because they are very much custodians of the listings. The surveyor to the fabric of St. Paul's had an interest as a good neighbour, mostly because they had a view of the rooftop terrace, which you see from the Golden Gallery. So they wanted something that they would be happy to view. And that affected not just the design, but also the lighting. Pretty much everything in the building is something that you couldn't touch without having that consultation with the bodies that I've just mentioned. We chose really to pursue an approach of balancing conservation with progress, so that we very much respected the identity of the building and its particular characteristics, but also wanted to introduce subtle enhancements. So I guess you'd call it a quiet architecture, which didn't shout, but hopefully has had a very high impact and has really helped people enjoy the building that much more and make it that much more of today.
Maybe you could talk me through some of the changes that you made.
Well, there were probably four key areas of the building that Obayashi, our client, asked us to look at. It was the entrance, as I mentioned earlier. They were very keen that this was a spacious impact space. Then the atrium. The requirement there was to improve daylighting to this area. But this is very much the soul of the building, the centrepiece. In the listing, it is really cited as having special architectural qualities, largely because of the glass-crete panelling. They also asked us to look at connectivity between the historic wings that Richardson designed and then the central plate that Hopkins designed, and lastly, the roof terrace. So going back to the atrium, that was quite a tough one because I think the defining characteristics of the atrium are that it has this moodiness. We call it almost a gothic film noir feel to it, possibly almost like coming off the set of Blade Runner. So I think it was a very deliberate move by Sir Michael to design it in that particular way. But when the client comes and asks you, can you improve the daylighting but don't spoil the set piece, it's a really big challenge. So again, it was a question of negotiation and consultation with the City of London and Historic England. And what we ended up doing was, I guess, similar to surgery. We didn't want to change the basic physiognomy of the atrium, so all the key features pretty much stayed in place. We just took out the centerpiece of the roofscape, which sits broadly over the central lift towers, and introduced clear glazing, but following very much the grid and discipline of all the glasscrete work, the glass block. So what you had was a significant improvement of daylighting, but what you looked up and saw was largely unchanged, or certainly unless you literally were comparing photo to photo, you wouldn't really have said, oh gosh, that's moved radically away from the way it had been designed. So It was being mindful of how the building had been designed, to look at the materiality, to consider the effect of what you're doing. And we did agonize about it for a long time. But the science proved that introducing just a little bit of clear glazing had a profound effect on daylighting penetration in the atrium space and indeed in the offices beyond it.
And I think you mentioned the entrance earlier. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, the entrance space, of course, is where most visitors and users will engage with the building or have their first impression of the building. The way Sir Michael Hopkins had originally designed this, it's located on Friday Street, was very much of the era of the 1990s. So the space, whilst it was impressive, was certainly constrained if you compare it to today's standards. And you entered via a ramp, which took you directly to a reception desk, which was pretty much centrally located. And you announced yourself, and you were then subsequently taken off into a side waiting room where you would be picked up by your host. Today, the requirement is different. The impact that you need to have on entering the building, certainly the impact and visibility entrance halls and reception spaces need to have, indeed from the street, is very important. So Obayashi asked us to look at that. Could we open up the reception space just a little bit more from the street, make that streetscape a little bit more vibrant and active before you even come into the building? And then when you come in, have a certain feeling of spaciousness. And most importantly, to make the waiting areas part of the space, which they hadn't been. So what did we do? We had to move bronze screens, which flanked the ramps, the central ramp on either side, and we clicked them over a couple of structural bays. But we didn't throw them away. We reused them. The City of London and Historic England very much wanted us to keep the character and identity of the space. So we reused and relocated the bronze and glass screens, but just moved them over. So the reception spaces that had, and or the waiting spaces that had been previously part of the innards of the building and out of sight, suddenly became an integral part of the reception space. And we parted the reception desk so that there was effectively two reception desks, which opened up a route directly to the main atrium and to the lifts and the primary circulation through the building. And most importantly, it direct visual link to the soul of the building, of this wonderful atrium, this terrific high-tech architecture, and a general feeling of spaciousness and generosity, where hopefully you will see the life and soul of the Financial Times, people meeting and greeting, breaking out, having informal meetings, and not just arriving as visitors.
That was architect David Magar, director at John Robertson Architects, speaking to Monocle's very own Christy Evans. Today we kick off with part one of our series on office furniture. Over the next 3 weeks, we'll speak to a furniture designer that's reshaping where and how we work. One company that's been in business since 1885 is the Swiss family-run modular furniture brand USM. Alexander Scherer, the CEO and president of USM, sat down recently with Monocle's Ben Rylan. They discussed, among other things, the importance of heritage and what it's like to be in charge of a family-run firm.
Well, the brand is born as a design element, you know, in the 60s, our iconic system, the Haller system. But of course, it has evolved a lot since then, you know, because by our integration into the office and home markets, it has evolved in different ways, but it's still an iconic design that is sold after 50 years. Sustainable product that our users, they love to keep it forever.
And of course, much of that is about this idea of a bespoke approach to what you do as well. At a time when a lot of design is becoming, I suppose you could say, arguably more accessible, a side of that would be that a lot of the design world is perhaps becoming a little bit too mass-produced. How do you see the idea of a bespoke approach? Is it becoming more important?
Well, I think especially also as we are progressing more in the home market, you know, and everybody at home has a different shape of his apartments. Apartments tend to get smaller, so of course we can react very well to this trend because we can use the space very effectively and really adapt, you know, the shelf or whatever to the house where the people live in. And as it's modular, you know, if you move to a different house, which is also people do that more and more often, I think, statistically, then you change it and adapt it to your new environment. I think that's definitely in the trend of today.
So would you say that this idea of being able to adapt your design aesthetic to wherever you're going to be traveling in the future, is that part of something that's very important to USM and the way you approach business?
Yes, that's really important. That's also, I think we struggle a bit sometimes, you know, to sell the furniture, let's say, in a place where we don't have any representation, because I think it's also very important, you know, the after-sales service, the adaptation, so that you really can call somebody if you need more product or if you need to alter it. And I think that is a challenge, you know, to implement that, of course, if you go into new geographies.
And I suppose part of that must be, I think a lot of designers have to deal with this idea of balancing the practical, functional nature of design, because of course all good design is functional. But with the visual aesthetic as well, how do you balance those two things at USM?
Yes, I think we had, like in the 60s, 70s, we had a sort of a playful approach, you know, a bit like the Lego to the theme. And then I think by our customers going a lot, you know, in the banking sector, so the product sort of got more serious, you know, black, white, and very ordinated. And I think that's what we are currently to break up a bit, you know, to go back to the roots, just to emphasize that playfulness of the product more, you know, so that you can really also make fun things with it and so on. I think that's something we emphasized in the past few years.
Does having a heritage as a company, a long history, does that actually make a difference to you as a company when you compare the way that USM approaches business to another company that may have only started last year or 5 years ago? Do you see that there is a difference in the way you both approach what you do?
Well, I think we have a bigger, maybe we produce more of the parts ourselves that typically, you know, if you would start a furniture company now, maybe you would rather act as an editor, not so much as a producer. You would have your things produced somewhere, so you would maybe also be tempted to change more often, or vice versa. Of course, if you invest heavily in production, you're also sort of locked into your principles more. I think that's a fundamental difference, I think, to a startup in the furniture business.
Take me a little bit deeper into that. The way you describe that is interesting. This idea of an editor as opposed to a producer, how do you see the practical differences between those two things?
Well, I think as an editor, I have maybe also a bit, but okay, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, but you have maybe a bit more, let's say, tolerance to error, because, you know, a product doesn't work, you just take it out of the catalog, you put something new in there. Whereas, of course, if you have a whole production behind it, you know, you have to adapt your tools, your machinery, etc., and it's a heavy investment. So, but it's a bit both-sided, of course, you know, because our brand is very well known, so I think it makes it also easier to sell than if it would just be a startup. So I don't think it's so black and white, this kind of difference.
You have a lower tolerance for mistakes and doing things wrong.
Yes, I think so. We cannot just put something out there and try, does it work or not? Because first of all, the reputation maybe would, you know, suffer. Secondly, yeah, as we would, you know, want to have this sustainable approach, you know, we would buy a new machine, but then do we just throw it away after 2 years or so? So I think it's a different approach.
Monocle's Ben Ryland there, speaking to Alexander Scherer, the CEO and president of USM, a specialist, we're told, in modular furniture. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. But next week,
one of the things that we always are drawn to is tactility. In the digital age where everything is sort of flat and we want to touch things,
some of our favourite designers of book covers bring their creations to the studio to help us ask what makes a book stand out on the shelf. And don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show plus our sister podcast On Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You might also fancy picking up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which is available on all self-respecting newsstands now, or head to monocle.com/shop for more of our collaborations, products, publications and more. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.